Stan, Venus Man Botticelli, no relation, was jolted out of his dreams of dancing girls and endless buffets by a seismic shock that threw him violently to the floor of his tastefully appointed bedroom. He immediately leaped to his feet, clad only in silk boxer shorts, flabby muscles tensed beneath his leathery flesh, looking left and right for the author of this indignity. As he huffed air at his nose, there came another massive jolt that sent him flying across the bed, scrabbling for purchase amid pricey linen sheets. Then the rumbling stopped and Stan rolled off the bed in one motion, grabbing the handheld two-way radio from the nightstand and depressing the button. "Parker! Parker, what the hell is going on over there?" There was a pause that seemed endless but was really only 10 seconds or so, and then a thick woman's voice emerged from the static. "Why the hell are you calling me at 6 a.m., Stan?" "I'm calling you because there's a fuck..." Another jolt knocked him off his feet, and he barked his shin painfully on the edge of the bed frame. In the midst of his colorful string of curses, he barely noticed that he had begun sliding toward the bedroom door. The radio in his hand squealed, then Rachel Parker's voice burst through again. "Stan, what was that noise?" Stan tried to grab hold of something, anything, but his grasping fingers slipped uselessly off the furniture. He managed to get the radio up to his lips. "Earthquake," he shrieked into it, his throat protesting such vigorous use. Glass was breaking everywhere in the house, and he had to shield his head as knickknacks came raining down from the shelving, followed by the shelving itself. He slid freely on the hardwood. Why hadn't he put carpet up here, for Christ's sake? And only stopped when he maneuvered awkwardly and wedged his leg in the doorway. "Bring the chopper," he screamed at the radio. "The whole place is falling apart." He used the door molding to leverage his way to an unsteady standing position. "And hurry up." "Oh, well, yes, sir," Parker said dryly. Then the radio went silent. The tremor stopped, but Stan wasn't letting that fact fool him again. Carefully, he reached behind the door and snagged his robe from the hook. He would have liked to be more presentable, but Parker had certainly seen him wearing less. Besides, he could get some proper clothes when she got him back to the mainland. For now, he just wanted to get the hell out of here before the walls came crashing down on him. From his vantage point at the top of the staircase, he could clearly see that the entire downstairs was in shambles. Paintings lying face down and torn, broken ceramic littering the floor, heavy chairs and tables jumbled against the west wall, black skid marks across the marble telling of their abrupt passage. Stan swore some more, then made himself calm down. Dropping the radio into the pocket of his robe, he began making his way toward the stairs, hanging onto the wall with flattened palms, knees bent to absorb another jolt. All was well until he was halfway down the steps, and then a tremor many times worse than the first two shook the building to its foundations. Stan was lifted off his feet and would have gone careening off into space had he not been holding the banister in a death grip. The radio slipped out of his pocket and shattered into a million pieces on the tile below. Ominous creaks had begun emitting from the ceiling. Stan didn't look up. When the tremor passed, Stan steadied himself on shaky legs and, mentally judging the distance to the front door, decided to make a run for it. One more tremor like the last one and the whole enchilada was coming down right on top of him. And as much as his affection for Rachel had waned over the years, he still didn't like the thought of her finding his broken carcass buried in a towering heap of expensive rubble. He wasted a few precious seconds breathing in and out, trying to work up his courage, then shut down his brain and let his survival instinct take over. He ran, his legs pumping, leaping over smashed vases and ruined art objects. He had nearly made it to the door when the world began to shake again. This time, the creaking of the masonry had become a roar, and Stan felt particles of dust landing on his head and shoulders as he ran. A moment later, there was a tremendous crash right behind him. Without turning to look, Stan assumed the destruction of his prized crystal chandelier. He reached the door and fumbled with the lock, praying to God and Mary and the baby Jesus that this pile would hold out for just a couple more seconds. And then the door was open and he was outside, the fishy, salty smell of the air like the sweetest perfume on earth. He tore across the circular driveway, not feeling the rough grade of the concrete on his bare feet. And as the rumble deepened, he threw himself into the grass, away from the house, and from his prone position finally turned his head, like Lot's wife, to see what was what. For a moment, he thought his vision must be skewed, because the entire house was leaning like a parallelogram, like the Pisa Monument. The glass had broken out of most of the windows, raining down like hail, and the chimney was dumping bricks down into the flower beds. There was a suspended instant in which all sound and motion ceased, and Stan thought that he was still in bed upstairs, and that his pleasant dancing girl's dream had taken a bizarre turn. But then a deafening thunder pierced the air, coming from deep below the ground, and the house went down in a single perfect arc, just as though it was made of nothing more substantial than playing cards or balsa wood. The cloud of dust and debris that followed was apocalyptic, seeming to blot out the sun, choking Stan in its gray-brown embrace. In the midst of this stifling darkness, Stan realized he was sliding again, or more accurately, tumbling off the carefully cultivated patch of grass that surrounded what was left of the house. He bumped along on the untended rocky terrain of the island, seeing nothing but the occasional flash of blue sky above him, then below him, as he rolled ass over tit. He thought he might have been screaming, but there was too much noise and darkness and chaos. He could have been dead for all he knew. When quiet came, it seemed very sudden, and Stan wondered if he'd blacked out, and if he had, for how long. He was aware that his throat felt raw and shredded, probably from screaming and coughing, but he also noticed that the air had cleared somewhat, allowing him to get a good look at what had happened to his island. Waving smoke away, he assessed his position. The quake had thrown him nearly to the waterline, which seemed much closer to the home site than it had been previously. To Stan, the reason for this soon became obvious. The entire island looked to have tilted about 30 degrees. Stan was reluctant to stand up for fear of a last devastating tremor that would plunge him into the gulf, so he rolled himself into a hunching stance, tucking his knees beneath him. He glanced briefly over at the ruin, not really lamenting the wreckage of the house, since he had others, but more irritated by the inconvenience and loss of dignity the whole episode had caused. Stan was used to being in control. He didn't like even Mother Nature thinking she could pull one over on him. And where the hell was Parker with that chopper? Would she even be able to land the thing? As he pondered these questions, Stan's roving gaze caught on something just at the shoreline. Furrowing his brow, he duck-walked over for a closer look. Something appeared to be wedged beneath the lip of the island, trapped on a sort of ledge formed by the new tilt of the land. The water was cloudy from the upheaval, and Stan couldn't really make it out. It looked white and sort of shiny, almost like satin. Whatever it was, it also looked very big. Stan had just leaned forward for a better look when he heard the unmistakable whir of propeller blades echoing across the waves. He turned to see the black silhouette of Parker's chopper superimposed against the pink morning sky. Forgetting the danger of further tremors and momentarily forgetting the strange white object in the water, Stan stood upright and waved his arms to greet the chopper. "You're a complete idiot, you know that, right?" Stan looked up from fiddling with his scuba mask. "Good thing you divorced me then, isn't it?" The chopper blades whacked above them as Parker guided the gleaming back machine over the clear teal waters of the gulf. Islands poked through the waves at odd intervals, beige sandy blots encircled by white froth. Stan still wasn't entirely sure what it was that he'd seen near the shore after the earthquake yesterday, but he had a hunch it might be something interesting. And following his hunches was what had made him his ill-gotten fortune, as well as kept him alive while he was making it. "The ground is probably unstable as hell," Parker was shouting over the roar of the engine. "You're lucky I even got you off there yesterday. If this baby goes into the gulf, I'm taking every cent out of your fat white ass." Stan laughed. Parker had always been abrasive, but it was one of the things he liked about her. Besides, he knew that deep down she was just as curious about all this as he was, maybe more. Rachel set the chopper down a little way from the ruin of the house, where the slope didn't seem quite so severe. Without a word, she then helped Stan unload his scuba gear and set it down on the beach. Once he had started to don the tank and flippers, she said, "If you find anything momentous, don't forget who rushed here at the ass crack of dawn when your house was falling down." She crossed her arms. Stan waddled over to her and kissed her brow. "I would never do such a thing. You're still my one and only." And it was true. Stan hadn't so much as touched another woman since Rachel had left him 3 years ago. "Be careful down there." She gave a wan little smile, the most emotion she generally ever showed. Stan nodded and gave her a jaunty salute, then flopped off toward the water. Once below the surface, Stan had to struggle to see much of anything. The water was still clouded with churned silt from yesterday's cataclysm. A few small yellow fish darted past his face before disappearing into the murk. Stan hoped there were no sharks sneaking up on him in the darkness. After a few moments, he became more accustomed to the blue-green gloom and was able to make out some vague shapes. He began to swim around what he hoped was the shoreline of the island, but something seemed amiss. He had been diving around here for many years, even before he had built the house, and as far as he knew, the island had always traced a smooth, barnacle-encrusted slope all the way to the sandy bottom of this fairly deep part of the gulf. But now the way ahead of him seemed dark and amorphous, not at all like the solid rock that should have been there. With a start, he realized that a cave had opened up right beneath the island. As soon as he'd internalized this fact, he began to see the curiously smooth rim of the thing, hanging there in the dimness, arching up and back. Well, he'd have to go in there. The interesting thing he'd seen had surely been forced up when the cave opened. Maybe it was a large mineral deposit unearthed after millions of years, or maybe some rare fossil of an unknown species. The possibilities made his skin tingle. Cautiously, mindful that the whole thing might collapse on him at any second, Stan glided into the blackness. Parker was certainly showing emotion today. She was standing on the deck of the freighter, her mouth hanging open, her eyes as big as saucers. "Unbelievable," she breathed, looking up at the thing. "That is fucking unbelievable." "Momentous enough for you, my dear?" Stan was pacing the deck, barely able to contain himself. The crew had spent the better part of 2 days extracting his prize from the wedge of newly yawning cave beneath the gulf, and now that Stan had seen it in its entirety, in its gigantic celestial glory, he was nearly exploding with happiness. "There's nothing else like it in the world," he said, unable to stop himself from bouncing up and down on the balls of his feet. "It's priceless, goddamn priceless. And we'll be famous, Parker. The Botticelli Parker Pearl. That has a certain ring to it, don't you think?" "I prefer the Parker Botticelli Pearl," Rachel said without taking her eyes off it. The pearl that had been liberated by the earthquake was nearly as big as Stan's ruined mansion had been, a perfect shimmering globe of color-shifting white, its surface as smooth as polished glass. It hung there like a captured planet, its beauty undiminished by the crisscrossing of heavy rope netting that kept it steady as the ship plowed its way toward the mainland. News of the discovery had already begun to circulate, of course. One couldn't hire an extraction crew without there being some rumors and leaks of information. Stan had already got word that the largest natural history museums in the world were engaging in a bidding war for the rights to display the extraordinary find. Stan would basically be able to take his pick and name his price. The prospect of making boatloads of cash naturally pleased him, but he was already a very wealthy man. He was infinitely more excited about the renown the pearl would bring him, the attachment of his name and legacy to something that was, for all intents and purposes, eternal. Hundreds of years from now, school children would listen in wonder as museum curators described the brave man who had risked his life to find the largest, most beautiful, most perfect pearl the world had ever seen. Stan sighed. He only wished his dear papa was still alive to see it. The sun had begun to set across the prow of the ship, and the pearl took on the lovely lavender-orange hue of the sky, reflecting and scattering the colors across its shining contours. Stan moved closer to it, his eyes brimming with joyful tears. He stared at it, adored it, and reached through the ropes to caress its satin skin, that was still as cold as the water at the bottom of the gulf. As the light grew dim, he fancied he could see the mirror image of his jowly, middle-aged face, looking back at him through gauzy layers of opalescence. And then, just before night fell completely, he thought he saw something else, the vaguest shadow within the pale globe, a shadow that seemed, for the briefest moment, to take the shape of a man. Stan emptied a bottle of Jack Daniels into one of the plastic cups from the minibar, and then knocked it back in one slug. He wished that Parker had taken him up on his offer to stay with him in the hotel tonight, but she had respectfully declined, heading back to her apartment after sharing one celebratory drink with him. Stan thought he'd be upset, but he found that he wasn't. Maybe Parker would come around, and maybe she wouldn't. He had the pearl, and as of now, that was all he really needed. His prize, and it would be the Botticelli Parker pearl, that much he had decided, was currently residing in a storage hangar less than a block away from where he was now sitting. Even though he and the crew had covered the treasure with yards of opaque sheeting before coming into port, there had still been a large crowd of curious onlookers on the shore to meet them. Stan was initially worried about all the attention, worried to let the pearl out of his sight for a single instant. But as it was carefully loaded onto a flatbed truck, he was able to convince himself he was overreacting. After all, who would be able to steal a pearl as big as a couple of jumbo jets? Pleasantly mellow, Stan went to the window of his hotel room and looked out into the night. He could just make out the curve of the shoreline, peppered with lights from docks and boathouses. He glanced to his left and saw the reassuring concrete and steel mass of the building that housed his ticket to immortality. The yellow moon hung over everything like a sister gem, shining in solidarity. He wasn't sure how long he was standing there, feeling the warm after-effects of the alcohol seeping into his veins, before he realized he was hearing a strange sound. He tilted his head toward the glass, trying to determine the source, but before he could, he had a visual to supplement the audio. The waves of the gulf were churning madly toward the shore, pounding at the beach with sudden, awesome force. At first, Stan simply frowned. Perhaps there was a storm whipping up over the water, although the forecast hadn't predicted one, and it was too early in the season for a hurricane. More likely, Stan thought, in light of his mansion's destruction, this was yet another aftershock from that fateful earthquake, now 4 days behind him. Could there be a tremor after 4 days? Stan wasn't sure. The waves were coming in earnest now, huge swells that lapped over the wooden decks and boat hulls along the beach, sending ropey white spray spattering the clapboard walls of the fishing shacks that line the dunes. Stan's frown deepened. He glanced up at the sky, but the night was clear, stars glittering hard against the blackness, no haze or squall line visible for miles. The earthquake theory was beginning to look like the more likely scenario. What if there was a tsunami? Stan had a vivid mental picture of his doll-like body being dragged into the depths of the gulf, along with the round, shimmering mass of his pearl, returning to its home beneath the waves. Stan decided he should turn on the TV, see if there was any evacuation warnings or other news about what the hell was going on. Before he could turn from the window, he noticed something else. By the cold yellow light of the moon, he swore he could see a massive dark shape in the water, moving toward the shore. He closed his eyes, then opened them again, the numbing effect of the whiskey dissolving in an instant. There was something. Something huge and mottled, moving in a bizarre, intermittent fashion, seeming to shoot forward quickly, stop, then move forward again, displacing enormous quantities of water before its dome-like bulk. Initially, Stan thought this must be his imagined tsunami, but he had to admit he'd never seen a wave move like that, jerky as a badly driven stick shift. Without taking his eyes off the thing, he fished in his pocket for his cell phone, dialing Parker's number from memory. She answered on the third ring, sounding a little drunk. "Yeah?" "Parker, you can see the gulf from your apartment window, can't you?" There was a pause. "Why?" she said. "Don't ask stupid questions." The thing was closer now, and Stan thought he could make out a surface that appeared to be jagged, grayish stone. "Look, I'm not sure what it is, but I think there's some bad shit going down. Just get in your car and start driving inland, okay? I'm gonna head out soon, too. I'll meet you..." He tried to think while the thing was growing larger and larger in his field of vision. "At that Denny's right there at the 19 junction. Got that?" "Stan, what the hell?" "Just do it!" The thing loomed massive now under the moonlight, its preceding waves smashing into the sands. Lights had started to come on in some of the houses, and shadowed people milled around on decks and balconies, clearly panicked. A child's shriek of terror penetrated the night. "All right, Stan, I'm going," Parker grumbled, "but I still wish you'd..." "Look out your damn window if you want to know why," he shouted and hung up. More screams were ringing in the streets below, and he started hearing doors slamming and the babble of voices in the hall outside his room. The thing was probably less than a half a mile offshore now, plowing up foam before it. Stan was poised to run, but he was momentarily transfixed by the sheer size of the thing and by its unnerving solidity. Jesus, the thing was easily the size of an island. Stan's whiskey-thinned blood turned to ice in his veins. Now that the thing was close, he realized that its contours were a little too familiar, the color and texture of its leading edge as known to him as the peaks and valleys of his own flesh. With horror, he recognized a shifting pile of debris on the thing's surface, as the fallen bricks and twisted wooden frame of the mansion he had once called home. "My island is coming to get me." The idea was so ridiculous that he laughed out loud. Even as people screamed in the streets, streaming out of their beach houses toward higher ground, he found that he couldn't stop laughing. What the fuck kind of earthquake is this, anyway? That question made him laugh even harder. Then he remembered his pearl, and the laughter dried up in his throat. He wasn't losing that pearl, vengeful island or no. Feet were pounding on the carpet out in the hall, and someone hammered at his door with closed fists, yelling for him to get out. Stan stood motionless for a moment more, watching the attacking hump of land closing in on the shoreline like the Kraken, and then he leaped into action, grabbing a coat from the bedspread and throwing it on over his rumpled suit, patting his pockets for keys and phone. He opened his door and slid into the crowd of straggling escapees, most bleary-eyed and frightened, a few in their pajamas. Stan threaded his way through them, anxious but purposeful. He was going to meet Parker by the highway soon enough, but he was going to check on that pearl first. If he couldn't find enough of the security guys around to help him load it back onto the truck, then he would just have to improvise. He might have to break into the hangar and roll the bitch all the way to US 19, but that was okay. He was certainly not leaving it here to be washed back out to sea, never to be found again. The hotel parking lot was almost empty as he crossed it, only a few slow movers starting their cars and peeling out toward the east. Stan broke into a jog, keeping one eye on the great looming hulk as he made his way to the storage hangar. The water hadn't quite come up this far yet, but he could see that it wouldn't be long before his feet got wet, if not the rest of him. The sentries at the hangar had presumably abandoned their posts. Stan swore at their cowardice. How was he going to get the pearl out now? He looked around in vain for something to break the lock on the massive sliding doors. Finally, he ducked into the guard shack, hoping that in the haste of evacuation, someone had left a set of keys behind. He was just reaching for a promising set when the moon was blotted out. Stan's heart stopped for a second, then tripped back into a rapid rhythm. He peered up through the dusty windows. The thing out there, the thing he'd been living on top of for 3 years, wasn't an island at all. Its mouth was open, an impossibly huge half-circle against the sky, the moon behind it giving its edges a blazing white corona. The inside of its upper shell shimmered, even in the darkness, with beautiful shifting colors, pink and blue and violet, as iridescent as metal, as the hues of a butterfly's wings. The froth around its lower shell surrounded it like a snowy beard. Stan's brain completely shut down, unable to process what it was seeing. He stood there, his mouth slack, his hand hanging in midair, reaching for a set of keys that he would never get the chance to use. The thing had pushed its enormous bulk partway under the shore, using muscles at its base to propel jets of water out behind it. Several of the houses along the shore were crushed to tinder, but there was no one inside them now. The beach was deserted except for Stan and the agent of his reckoning. Stan Botticelli, known as the Venus Man by his associates and enemies, had a moment to admire the rosy, quivering flesh inside the thing's mouth, the soft bed where the pearl had grown to its exquisite adulthood, and then the darkness descended. The next morning, the sun crept up slowly, as if reluctant to shed light on the consequences of the night's events. Buildings, roads, and cars were smashed flat in an oddly and almost perfectly circular pattern that extended outward for several miles. Everything was wet. The roads along the shore were strewn with dead fish and green ropes of seaweed. The hangar that had briefly housed the most extraordinary find of the young century was reduced to a pile of twisted steel and broken concrete. No trace of the pearl was ever discovered, even by those who bothered to look. Rachel Parker, who instead of heading inland as she'd been told, had driven to Stan's hotel to talk some sense into him, was reported missing by her mother a few days after the incident. Beneath the newly calm waters of the Gulf, the upper and lower shells of the Leviathan came together with a satisfying snap, the arch of its back once again forming a round, tranquil island with gentle, barnacle-encrusted slopes. And inside the shell, Botticelli and Parker lay curled together as if sleeping, surrounded by sand and wood splinters and shattered glass and broken car parts. Their bodies rested on the pink, fleshy bed that lined the lower shell, their intertwined flesh serving as the shadowy catalyst, wading through the long years, as layer after gauzy layer, it became part of the beauty of the natural world, and thus achieved a sort of immortality, just biding the time beneath the waves, waiting for discovery. Until the extraordinary affair at Sidmouth, the peculiar species Haplotuthis ferox was known to science only generically, on the strength of a half-digested tentacle obtained near the Azores, and a decaying body pecked by birds and nibbled by fish, found early in 1896 by Mr. Jennings near Land's End. In no department of zoological science, indeed, are we quite so much in the dark as with regard to the deep-sea cephalopods. A mere accident, for instance, it was, that led to the Prince of Monaco's discovery of nearly a dozen new forms in the summer of 1895, a discovery in which the before-mentioned tentacle was included. It chanced that a cachalot was killed off Terceira by some sperm whalers, and in its last struggles charged almost to the prince's yacht, missed it, rolled under, and died within 20 yards of his rudder. And in its agony, it threw up a number of large objects, which the prince, dimly perceiving they were strange and important, was, by a happy expedient, able to secure before they sank. He set his screws in motion and kept them circling in the vortices thus created until a boat could be lowered. And these specimens were whole cephalopods and fragments of cephalopods, some of gigantic proportions, and almost all of them unknown to science. It would seem, indeed, that these large and agile creatures, living in the middle depths of the sea, must to a large extent forever remain unknown to us, since underwater they are too nimble for nets, and it is only by such rare, unlooked-for accidents that specimens can be obtained. In the case of Haplotuthis ferox, for instance, we are still altogether ignorant of its habitat, as ignorant as we are of the breeding ground of the herring or the seaways of the salmon. And zoologists are altogether at a loss to account for its sudden appearance on our coast. Possibly it was the stress of a hunger migration that drove it hither out of the deep. But it will be, perhaps, better to avoid necessarily inconclusive discussion, and to proceed at once with our narrative. The first human being to set eyes upon a living Haploteuthis, the first human being to survive, that is, for there can be little doubt now that the wave of bathing fatalities and boating accidents that traveled along the coast of Cornwall and Devon in early May was due to this cause, was a retired tea dealer by the name of Fison, who was stopping at a Sidmouth boarding house. It was in the afternoon, and he was walking along the cliff path between Sidmouth and Ladrum Bay. The cliffs in this direction are very high, but down the red face of them, in one place, a kind of ladder staircase has been made. He was near this when his attention was attracted by what at first he thought to be a cluster of birds struggling over a fragment of food that caught the sunlight and glistened pinkish-white. The tide was right out, and this object was not only far below him, but remote across a broad waste of rock reefs covered with dark seaweed and interspersed with silvery shining tidal pools. And he was, moreover, dazzled by the brightness of the further water. In a minute, regarding this again, he perceived that his judgment was at fault, for over this struggle circled a number of birds, jackdaws and gulls for the most part, the latter gleaming blindingly when the sunlight smote their wings, and they seemed minute in comparison with it. And his curiosity was, perhaps, aroused all the more strongly because of his first insufficient explanations. As he had nothing better to do than amuse himself, he decided to make this object, whatever it was, the goal of his afternoon walk, instead of Ladrum Bay, conceiving it might perhaps be a great fish of some sort, stranded by some chance and flapping about in its distress. And so he hurried down the long, steep ladder, stopping at intervals of 30 feet or so to take breath and scan the mysterious movement. At the foot of the cliff, he was, of course, nearer his object than he had been, but on the other hand, it now came up against the incandescent sky beneath the sun so as to seem dark and indistinct. Whatever was pinkish of it was now hidden by a scurry of weedy boulders. But he perceived that it was made up of 7 rounded bodies, distinct or connected, and that the birds kept up a constant croaking and screaming, but seemed afraid to approach it too closely. Mr. Fison, torn by curiosity, began picking his way across the wave-worn rocks, and finding the wet seaweed that covered them thickly rendered them extremely slippery, he stopped, removed his shoes and socks, and rolled his trousers above his knees. His object was, of course, merely to avoid stumbling into the rocky pools about him, and perhaps he was rather glad, as all men are, of an excuse to resume, even for a moment, the sensations of his boyhood. At any rate, it is to this, no doubt, that he owes his life. He approached his mark with all the assurance which the absolute security of this country against all forms of animal life gives its inhabitants. The round bodies moved to and fro, but it was only when he surmounted the scurry of boulders I have mentioned that he realized the horrible nature of the discovery. It came upon him with some suddenness. The rounded bodies fell apart as he came into sight over the ridge and displayed the pinkish object to be the partially devoured body of a human being, but whether of a man or woman he was unable to say. And the rounded bodies were new and ghastly-looking creatures, in shape somewhat resembling an octopus, with huge and very long and flexible tentacles coiled copiously on the ground. The skin had a glistening texture, unpleasant to see, like shiny leather. The downward bend of the tentacle-surrounded mouth, the curious excrescence at the bend, the tentacles, and the large, intelligent eyes gave the creatures a grotesque suggestion of a face. They were the size of a fair-sized swine about the body, and the tentacles seemed to him to be many feet in length. There were, he thinks, 7 or 8 at least of the creatures. 20 yards beyond them, amid the surf of the now-returning tide, 2 others were emerging from the sea. Their bodies lay flatly on the rocks, and their eyes regarded him with evil interest, but it does not appear that Mr. Fison was afraid or that he realized that he was in any danger. Possibly his confidence is to be ascribed to the limpness of their attitudes. But he was horrified, of course, and intensely excited and indignant at such revolting creatures preying upon human flesh. He thought they had chanced upon a drowned body. He shouted to them, with the idea of driving them off, and finding they did not budge, cast about him, picked up a big rounded lump of rock and flung it at one. And then, slowly uncoiling their tentacles, they all began moving towards him, creeping at first deliberately and making a soft purring sound to each other. In a moment, Mr. Fison realized that he was in danger. He shouted again, threw both his boots, and started off with a leap forthwith. 20 yards off, he stopped and faced about, judging them slow, and behold, the tentacles of their leader were already pouring over the rocky ridge on which he had just been standing. At that, he shouted again, but this time not threatening, but a cry of dismay, and began jumping, striding, slipping, wading across the uneven expanse between him and the beach. The tall red cliffs seemed suddenly at a vast distance, and he saw, as though they were creatures in another world, two minute workmen engaged in the repair of the ladderway, and little suspecting the race for life that was beginning below them. At one time, he could hear the creatures splashing in the pools not a dozen feet behind him, and once he slipped and almost fell. They chased him to the very foot of the cliffs, and desisted only when he had been joined by the workmen at the foot of the ladderway up the cliff. All three of the men pelted them with stones for a time, and then hurried to the clifftop and along the path towards Sidmouth to secure assistance and a boat, and to rescue the desecrated body from the clutches of these abominable creatures. And, as if he had not already been in sufficient peril that day, Mr. Fison went with the boat to point out the exact spot of his adventure. As the tide was down, it required a considerable detour to reach the spot, and when at last they came off the ladderway, the mangled body had disappeared. The water was now running in, submerging first one slab of slimy rock and then another, and the four men in the boat, the workmen, that is, the boatman and Mr. Fison, now turned their attention from the bearings offshore to the water beneath the keel. At first, they could see little below them, save a dark jungle of laminaria, with an occasional darting fish. Their minds were set on adventure, and they expressed their disappointment freely. But presently they saw one of the monsters, swimming through the water seaward, with a curious rolling motion that suggested to Mr. Fison the spinning roll of a captive balloon. Almost immediately after, the waving streamers of laminaria were extraordinarily perturbed, parted for a moment, and three of these beasts became darkly visible, struggling for what was probably some fragment of the drowned man. In a moment, the copious olive-green ribbons had poured again over this writhing group. At that, all four men, greatly excited, began beating the water with oars and shouting, and immediately they saw a tumultuous movement among the weeds. They desisted to see more clearly, and as soon as the water was smooth, they saw, as it seemed to them, the whole sea bottom among the weeds, set with eyes. "Ugly swine," cried one of the men. "Why, there's dozens." And forthwith, the things began to rise through the water about them. Mr. Fison has since described to the writer this startling eruption out of the waving laminaria meadows. To him, it seemed to occupy a considerable time, but it is probable that really it was an affair of a few seconds only. For a time, nothing but eyes, and then he speaks of tentacles streaming out and parting the weed fronds this way and that. Then these things, growing larger, until at last the bottom was hidden by their intercoiling forms, and the tips of tentacles rose darkly here and there into the air above the swell of the waters. One came up boldly to the side of the boat, and clinging to this with three of its sucker-set tentacles, threw four others over the gunwale, as if with an intention either of oversetting the boat or of clambering into it. Mr. Fison at once caught up the boat hook, and jabbing furiously at the soft tentacles, forced it to desist. He was struck in the back and almost pitched overboard by the boatman, who was using his oar to resist a similar attack on the other side of the boat. But the tentacles on either side at once relaxed their hold, slid out of sight, and splashed into the water. "We'd better get out of this," said Mr. Fison, who was trembling violently. He went to the tiller, while the boatman and one of the workmen seated themselves and began rowing. The other workmen stood up in the forepart of the boat, with the boat hook, ready to strike any more tentacles that might appear. Nothing else seems to have been said. Mr. Fison had expressed the common feeling beyond amendment. In a hushed, scared mood, with faces white and drawn, they set about escaping from the position into which they had so recklessly blundered. But the oars had scarcely dropped into the water before dark, tapering, serpentine ropes had bound them and were about the rudder, and creeping up the sides of the boat with a looping motion came the suckers again. The men gripped their oars and pulled, but it was like trying to move a boat in a floating raft of weeds. "Help here," cried the boatman, and Mr. Fison and the second workman rushed to help lug at the oar. Then the man with the boat hook, his name was Ewan, sprang up with a curse and began striking downward over the side, as far as he could reach, at the bank of tentacles that now clustered along the boat's bottom. and at the same time the two rowers stood up to get a better purchase for the recovery of their oars. The boatman handed his to Mr. Fison, who lugged desperately, and meanwhile the boatman opened a big clasp knife and, leaning over the side of the boat, began hacking at the spiring arms upon the oar shaft. Mr. Fison, staggering with the quivering rocking of the boat, his teeth set, his breath coming short, and the veins starting on his hands as he pulled at his oar, suddenly cast his eyes seaward. And there, not 50 yards off, across the long rollers of the incoming tide, was a large boat standing in towards them, with three women and a little child in it. A boatman was rowing, and a little man in a pink ribbon straw hat and whites stood in the stern hailing them. For a moment, of course, Mr. Fison thought of help, and then he thought of the child. He abandoned his oar forthwith, threw up his arms in a frantic gesture, and screamed to the party in the boat to keep away, for God's sake. It says much for the modesty and courage of Mr. Fison that he does not seem to be aware that there was any quality of heroism in his action at this juncture. The oar he had abandoned was at once drawn under, and presently reappeared, floating about 20 yards away. At the same moment, Mr. Fison felt the boat under him lurch violently, and a hoarse scream, a prolonged cry of terror from Hill, the boatman, causing him to forget the party of excursionists altogether. He turned and saw Hill crouching by the forward rowlock, his face convulsed with terror, and his right arm over the side, and drawn tightly down. He gave now a succession of short, sharp cries. Mr. Fison believes that he must have been hacking at the tentacles below the waterline and have been grasped by them, but of course it is quite impossible to say now certainly what had happened. The boat was heeling over, so that the gunwale was within 10 inches of the water, and both Ewan and the other laborer was striking down into the water with oar and boat hook on either side of Hill's arm. Mr. Fison instinctively placed himself to counterpoise them. Then Hill, who was a burly, powerful man, made a strenuous effort and rose almost to a standing position. He lifted his arm, indeed, clean out of the water. Hanging to it was a complicated tangle of brown ropes, and the eyes of one of the brutes that had hold of him, glaring straight and resolute, showed momentarily above the surface. The boat heeled more and more, and the green-brown water came pouring in a cascade over the side. Then Hill slipped and fell with his ribs across the side, and his arm and the massive tentacles about it splashed back into the water. He rolled over, his boot kicked Mr. Fison's knee as that gentleman rushed forward to seize him, and in another moment fresh tentacles had whipped about his waist and neck, and after a brief convulsive struggle, in which the boat was nearly capsized, Hill was lugged overboard. The boat righted with a violent jerk that all but sent Mr. Fison over the other side and hid the struggle in the water from his eyes. He stood staggering to recover his balance for a moment, and as he did so, he became aware that the struggle and the inflowing tide had carried them close upon the weedy rocks again. Not 4 yards off, a table of rock still rose in rhythmic movements above the inwash of the tide. In a moment, Mr. Fison seized the oar from Ewan, gave one vigorous stroke, then dropping it, ran to the bows and leapt. He felt his feet slide over the rock, and by a frantic effort, leapt again towards a further mass. He stumbled over this, came to his knees, and rose again. "Look out!" cried someone, and a large drab body struck him. He was knocked flat into a tidal pool by one of the workmen, and as he went down he heard smothered, choking cries that he believed at the time came from Hill. Then he found himself marveling at the shrillness and variety of Hill's voice. Someone jumped over him, and a curving rush of foamy water poured over him and passed. He scrambled to his feet, dripping, and without looking seaward, ran as fast as his terror would let him, shoreward. Before him, over the flat space of scattered rocks, stumbled the two workmen, one a dozen yards in front of the other. He looked over his shoulder at last, and seeing that he was not pursued, faced about. He was astonished. From the moment of the rising of the cephalopods out of the water, he had been acting too swiftly to fully comprehend his actions. Now it seemed to him as if he had suddenly jumped out of an evil dream. For there was the sky, cloudless and blazing with the afternoon sun, the sea weltering under its pitiless brightness, the soft, creamy foam of the breaking water, and the low, long, dark ridges of rock. The righted boat floated, rising and falling gently on the swell, about a dozen yards from shore. Hill and the monsters, all the stress and tumult of that fierce fight for life, had vanished as though they had never been. Mr. Fison's heart was beating violently, he was throbbing to the fingertips, and his breath came deep. There was something missing. For some seconds, he could not think clearly enough what this might be. Sun, sky, sea, rocks? What was it? Then he remembered the boatload of excursionists. It had vanished. He wondered whether he had imagined it. He turned and saw the two workmen standing side by side under the projecting masses of the tall pink cliffs. He hesitated whether he should make one last attempt to save the man Hill. His physical excitement seemed to desert him suddenly and leave him aimless and helpless. He turned shoreward, stumbling and wading towards his two companions. He looked back again, and there were now two boats floating, and the one farthest out at sea pitched clumsily, bottom upward. So it was that Haplotuthis ferox made its appearance upon the Devonshire coast. So far, this has been its most serious aggression. Mr. Fison's account, taken together with the wave of boating and bathing casualties to which I have already alluded, and the absence of fish from the Cornish coasts that year, points clearly to a shoal of these voracious deep-sea monsters prowling slowly along the subtidal coastline. Hunger migration has, I know, been suggested as the force that drove them hither, but for my own part, I prefer to believe the alternative theory of Hemsley. Hemsley holds that a pack or shoal of these creatures may have become enamored of human flesh by the accident of a foundered ship sinking among them, and have wandered in search of it out of their accustomed zone, first waylaying and following ships, and so coming to our shores in the wake of the Atlantic traffic. But to discuss Hemsley's cogent and admirably stated arguments would be out of place here. It would seem that the appetites of the shoal were satisfied by the catch of 11 people, for, so far as can be ascertained, there were 10 people in the second boat, and certainly these creatures gave no further signs of their presence off Sidmouth that day. The coast between Seaton and Budleigh Salterton was patrolled all that evening and night by four preventive service boats, the men in which were armed with harpoons and cutlasses, and as the evening advanced, a number of more or less similarly equipped expeditions, organized by private individuals, joined them. Mr. Fison took no part in any of these expeditions. About midnight, excited hails were heard from a boat about a couple of miles out at sea to the southeast of Sidmouth, and a lantern was seen waving in a strange manner to and fro and up and down. The nearer boats at once hurried towards the alarm. The venturesome occupants of the boat, a seaman, a curate, and two schoolboys, had actually seen the monsters passing under their boat. The creatures, it seems, like most deep-sea organisms, were phosphorescent, and they had been floating, 5 fathoms deep or so, like creatures of moonshine through the blackness of the water, their tentacles retracted and as if asleep rolling over and over, and moving slowly in a wedge-like formation towards the southeast. These people told their story in gesticulated fragments as first one boat drew alongside and then another. At last, there was a little fleet of 8 or 9 boats collected together, and from them a tumult, like the chatter of a marketplace, rose into the stillness of the night. There was little or no disposition to pursue the shoal. The people had neither weapons nor experience for such a dubious chase, and presently, even with a certain relief, it may be, the boats turned shoreward. And now to tell what is perhaps the most astonishing fact in this whole astonishing raid. We have not the slightest knowledge of the subsequent movements of the shoal, although the whole southwest coast was now alert for it. But it may perhaps be significant that a cachalot was stranded off Sark on June the 3rd. 2 weeks and 3 days after the Sidmouth affair, a living Haplotuthis came ashore on Calais Sands. It was alive because several witnesses saw its tentacles moving in a convulsive way, but it is probable that it was dying. A gentleman named Pouchet obtained a rifle and shot it. That was the last appearance of a living Haplotuthis. No others were seen on the French coast. On the 15th of June, a dead carcass, almost complete, was washed ashore near Torquay, and a few days later, a boat from the Marine Biological Station, engaged in dredging off Plymouth, picked up a rotting specimen, slashed deeply with a cutlass wound. How the former had come by its death, it is impossible to say. And on the last day of June, Mr. Egbert Kane, an artist, bathing near Newlyn, threw up his arms, shrieked, and was drawn under. A friend bathing with him made no attempt to save him, but swam at once for the shore. This was the last fact to tell of this extraordinary raid from the deeper sea. Whether it is really the last of these horrible creatures, it is as yet premature to say. But it is believed, and certainly it is to be hoped, that they have returned now, and returned for good, to the sunless depths of the Middle Seas, out of which they have so strangely and so mysteriously arisen.